From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour is made in Youngstown, Ohio, or Detroit, Michigan, or pick Rochester, New York, cities where large employers once paid the salaries for tens of thousands of American workers, cities where those large employers are gone and questions remain about how to build something new in their place. And now comes a new book with a proposed solution. MIT economist Jonathan Gruber is best known for being one of the architects of the Affordable Care Act. He's been a healthcare reformer, and he's the co-author of the new book, Jumpstarting America: How Breakthrough Science Can Revive Economic Growth. Gruber believes that these hollowed-out towns and communities can be rebuilt despite the economic trends that see most of the jobs moving to a small number of larger cities, often coastal enclaves. His book offers ideas on how to change that. Can it work? Well, he is in Rochester today. There's an event to tell you about tonight, but first, he is our guest right here on Connections for the Hour. So Jonathan Gruber, professor of economics at MIT. I was going to say RIT. You're from MIT. Welcome. Welcome to the town of RIT. Thanks so much.
It's great to be here.
Great to have you. Jim Sinal is here, president of NextCore, Inc. and managing director of the Rochester Angel Network. Welcome back to you, and remind our listeners what the Rochester Angel Network
is. Sure. Thank you, Evan. The Angel Network is a group of investors that invest in startup companies. And for those that don't know, NextCore, formerly known as HiTech Rochester, we run tech incubators, accelerators, and consulting services to help grow companies and jobs here.
Jim will be part of a panel discussion tonight with Professor Gruber, and that is happening at the Hawkins Carlson Room at University of Rochester's Rush Reese Library. Starts at 6:30. So 6:30 tonight at Rush Reese at the U of R, followed by a book signing with Jonathan Gruber if you want to attend for that. Now, certainly we're going to go in a lot of different directions on the economy, but our listeners find out you're coming this morning, and the first thing I get is a wave of questions on healthcare, which you can't escape, and that's fine. So I want to start by asking you about how you see the current campaign, and the campaigns in this country last forever. So we're already in a new presidential campaign. And it is not just a Republican target, the Affordable Care Act. You got a lot of Democrats, not all, talking about Medicare for all or some sort of a flavor of a single payer. And you recently told Fox News' Maria Bartiromo, among others, that single payer is just not politically feasible. That's how you feel? Not politically going to happen?
Yeah, I feel quite strongly about that. Look, there's three fundamental problems you face with single payer. The first is our health care is paid in America by what economists call an implicit or hidden tax. When your employer offers you health insurance, they don't do it out of the goodness of their heart. They do it because they need to attract you, and they do it by paying you lower wages. Single payer would replace that hidden tax with an open tax, and that's not politically very helpful. The second problem is 180 million Americans have private health insurance that they by and large like. You think about the trouble the Affordable Care Act got into, over 2 million Americans losing their crappy insurance policies. Think about 180 million Americans losing high-quality insurance policies. That's a big problem. And finally, we have a $900 billion private health insurance industry in America. They're not going to say, hey, it's been a good run, we're happy to go away. No, they're going to fight it, and we don't win. The government doesn't win when they take on industries that size.
Well, but when it comes to health insurance, let's look at the CDC data, 2018 data. The number of uninsured Americans has fell by 19.7 million from 2010 to 2018. So the number of uninsured Americans has gone down pretty dramatically. However, in 2016, 39% of individuals with private health coverage had a high deductible plan. That increased to 43% by 2018. If your deductible is $6,000, do you actually have health insurance?
Yes, you do. Let's remember what the word insurance means. It means protection against financial risk. And what's financial risk? It means spending too high a share of your income. For many individuals, a $6,000 deductible. Now, for a sick individual, hit it year after year after year, that is very high. But for many individuals, they can afford to deal with a one-time shock of $6,000, okay? And for those individuals, they still have insurance. What they can afford is having a heart attack and having a $100,000 bill. And the problem with insurance before the Affordable Care Act is you could have plans which said, don't worry, you're covered, but by the way, if it's more than $10,000, you're not covered anymore. Now, that's not insurance. That's the opposite of insurance. So yes, a plan with a $6,000 deductible is insurance, but not for someone who has low means. That's why in the Affordable Care Act, we actually say if your income's lower, we're going to help offset those deductibles by getting more generous insurance to help offset that.
Okay, and I'm thinking of people who may not go to the doctor if they've got some sort of a medical malady that isn't catastrophic. Maybe it's not a $75,000 broken leg surgery. You're right, that could be bankrupting without insurance. But if people are not going because they have such a high deductible, I'm not sure they really do have full insurance.
Well, look, there's always the thing about healthcare, the number one rule is there's never an easy yes or right or wrong. It's all about trade-offs. The trade-off here is if you make healthcare free for everyone, then no one will be disturbed from going to the doctor, but it will cost us, best estimates are, 20 to 25% more. We already spend $3.5 trillion on healthcare in America. Do we really want to spend another $700, $800 billion? There, on the other hand, we don't want to dissuade people from getting needed care. That's why, once again, the devil's in the details. In the Affordable Care Act, those high deductible plans all include for free two primary care visits, two or three, I forget which, primary care visits a year. So before the deductible, you get to go to have a primary care visit. So we are trying to make that balance. Is the balance right? It may or may not be. That's a debate we should be having as a society. But let's not have that debate be rip it all up and start over. Let's have the debate be, well, maybe it shouldn't be 6,000, maybe it should be 4,000.
Yeah, I definitely see the complexity of a system like this. You can't 5 years into a new system say, well, it didn't work perfectly, throw the whole thing out. I mean, I understand the desire to tweak it, but I also see the popularity increasing of Medicare for All or pick these different. So I guess what I want to make sure I understand from you, Professor Gruber, is, you know, when you say something like Medicare for All or single payer healthcare is not politically feasible, you're really making the argument that it's just not better, that it's not a good idea to begin with, as opposed to politically feasible.
No, I'm not saying that at all.
Okay.
I think there are arguments on either side of single payer, and quite frankly, I don't spend a lot of time thinking at them because it's politically infeasible. Politically infeasible doesn't mean not better. It means there's basically, let me give you a simple example. I work for the state of Vermont, which wanted to propose single payer. And I thought if it's going to happen anywhere, it's Vermont, right? Leftiest state in the nation. They essentially have one insurer, which is Blue Cross. So I did the modeling for them. I ran the numbers. The good news was if they put in single payer, total healthcare costs in Vermont were going to fall by at least 10%. That's a big win. Okay. The bad news was to pay for it, they had to double the entire taxes collected in the state of Vermont. Now, as an economist, I'd say, well, who cares if you double taxes? You double taxes, but wages go up and it all offsets. And at the end of the day, all we care about is total healthcare spending. That doesn't sell so well on the stump. And the minute those numbers came out, the plan died. So it's not about good idea, bad idea. It's about the fact that it is hard to transition from the status quo, especially, as the Affordable Care Act found out, when you have opponents who will exploit the difficulties and make it sound worse than it is.
Yeah, when Governor Shumlin pulled the plug there, it did disappoint a lot of the, I would say, Senator Bernie Sanders, his acolytes, and many supporters of single payer, because you're right, they looked at that state, which is roughly the size of Monroe County in population, saying that maybe this is a good little laboratory to do it. But now the argument is, well, you can't do it piece by piece. You'd have to do it sort of whole scale. And I do want to listen to, and I don't know if Professor Gruber is a big fan of Senator Bernie Sanders, but I do want to listen to the comments that he made on a Fox News town hall about this. The headlines really came from the reaction of a Fox News crowd when he was talking about Medicare for All. This is just a couple of days ago. Let's listen.
Millions of people every single year lose their health insurance. You know why? They get fired or they quit and they go to another employer. I was the mayor for 8 years. You know what I did? What probably every mayor in America does? Is you look around for the best insurance program, the most cost-effective insurance. You change insurance. Every year, millions of workers wake up in the morning and their employer has changed the insurance that they have. Maybe they like the doctors. People are nodding their heads. Okay, so this is not new. Every year. Now, what we're talking about actually is stability. That when you have a Medicare for All, it is there now and it will be there in the future.
That's on Fox News, and the applause indicates that maybe the caricature of single payer as something that just the far left wants is gaining more traction elsewhere. Do you buy that?
Look, I wish I bought it, but look at the poll numbers. If you ask people if they support single payer, about 65% say yes. If you simply say, do you support if your taxes have to go up, it drops to 30%. Do you say, do you support if you have to give up the insurance you have now, it drops to 30%. And the bottom line is, I think I love what Bernie's doing as an aspiration. I got in a big debate on Fox News about this, where Fox News would like to say, well, any healthcare reform, you know, it's all single payer. It's not all single payer. We're setting an aspiration. I think what Bernie was doing is laying out the fact this is where we want to get to. It's going to be a road to get there. To say single payer or nothing, to set that litmus test, I think is dangerous. I think we have to take the steps to get there. I love that aspiration, and maybe someday we'll get there, but it's not going to be today. And so we need to make sure we take constructive steps forward, not backwards.
So when Senator Kamala Harris says it's time for the end of private insurance for health insurance in this country, you say too soon?
I say too soon. I say basically, A, people don't want to give it up for some unknown thing called Bernie Care, and B, you've got a too powerful industry you're taking on. Let's instead do what some have suggested, like what Beto O'Rourke has signed on to, which is called Medicare for America, which is basically let's allow people the option of choosing Medicare, okay, without having to give up their private health insurance. Once you do that, then you don't upset the 180 million Americans. They want to keep it, that's fine. But you then introduce Americans to the possibility of an option, and or maybe let's say let's make the Medicare eligibility age down from 65 to 60. Let's just start with incremental moves. I think what is frustrating, actually, look at the opposition to the Affordable Care Act, and for a long time it was underwater. More than 50% of people didn't like it. But if you broke that down, almost half those people didn't like it because it didn't go far enough. And basically, I think we have to remember the real politics of America, that we can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. I like what Bernie's talking about. I think it's great aspirational. But if we hold out for that or nothing, we're going to end up with nothing.
When it comes to how you would tweak, there's probably hundreds of ways you could tweak the Affordable Care Act. Specifically, what's the top of the list? If you're back in the room and you can make a few policy changes happen, where are the big tweaks that need to happen?
So there's basically two big tweaks that need to happen. The first is that Trump and the Republicans have essentially broken these individual exchanges. The exchanges were actually doing pretty well before the 2016 election. I know we all remember that premiums went up in the fall of 2016, but we don't remember is they actually came in 20% below expectations. And if you look over the whole period, over the first 3 years, they rose at about 7% a year, which is pretty good. They were doing okay. But basically, Trump then, by doing things like upsetting insurers and getting the individual mandate, has essentially skyrocketed premiums. We need to stabilize those exchanges again. The way to do that is through what some states are doing with innovative reinsurance programs, where you essentially inject some money to stabilize the market, to reinsure it. The second thing we need to do is recognize that the Affordable Care Act still has a pretty important hole for people who are not very poor but are not well off. People who, with income, say, between like $20,000 and $50,000, $20,000, $45,000, they can't afford a $6,000 deductible. And we need to help them. We need to help that population more. So I think we need to both stabilize the exchange markets, we'd help them more, and we need to get those states that are not expanding their Medicaid program. The federal government is saying to Florida, Florida, you've got a million uninsured people below the poverty line. We will pay 100% of the costs initially and 90% eventually. We'll have other states pay to cover your uninsured individuals. Why is Florida saying no? It's political malpractice.
All right, one more question on healthcare, and then we're going to turn to Professor Gruber's new book. In an interview you did in 2014 on MSNBC, you made some remarks about how policy kind of gets done. And last week on this program, we had a pretty robust discussion on UBI, Universal Basic Income, which has been proposed by Andrew Yang, among some others. And proponents of UBI point to case studies showing that it tends to be, at least if you look at Canada or if you look at parts of Africa where it's been done, more efficient for the government's there to just give people money directly than saying, okay, here's a voucher for this, or here's a voucher for housing, or here's food stamps. But it can be politically unpopular. And here's what you said on MSNBC regarding back 5 years ago. I'm sure everyone remembers your viral remarks that went out that were talking about transparency or the way you kind of had to massage certain aspects of the ACA to make sure it passed and it was sort of politically palatable. But I think this relates to a broader discussion about how policy gets done. I want to listen to what you said about that.
It would have made more sense to do Obamacare the way we did in Massachusetts, which would be to just actually give people money to offset the cost of their health insurance. That was politically infeasible. And so instead it was done through the tax code. And that's the only point I was making.
I guess what I want to understand here is if you as an economist or if Barack Obama or political leaders see something as a better idea, but you feel like you can't sell it, why not just sell it harder? Why does it have to be sort of dressed up in some ways?
You know, it's a great question. And I'm not an expert. And when I try conjecture on politics is when I get in trouble. But, you know, one criticism I think is unfair. A lot of people got mad at Obama for not selling the Affordable Care Act harder. Look, there's an old Mark Twain saying, which is a lie will get halfway around the world before the truth gets its boots on. It's hard to sell these things, especially when they're complicated. And if you think about universal basic income, once again, a lot of points to recommend it. Great evidence from both abroad and the U.S. that universal basic income could increase people, lift people out of poverty without causing them to work less hard. But then someone's going to go on 60 Minutes and saying, we're sending Bill Gates a check for $5,000 a year, because universal is universal. And then all of a sudden, that anecdote it destructive. So I think that you have to recognize that it's not as simple as saying it's a good idea. You've got to deal with criticism from a variety of different directions. That's not to say it can't happen. It's a great, great chance to pivot to the book. One example we point to in the book, we talk in the book about redistributing the revenues from technology. An example we point to is the Alaska Permanent Fund. Here's the most conservative state in the nation that every year sends every resident a check for $1,000 to $2,000 a year. It lifts 20,000 Alaskans out of poverty, and it's highly popular. So it can happen. It's just a question of how you get there.
Do you support a UBI?
I do not support a UBI. I support a much larger but still income-targeted Democrat. So, for example, if you look at what the recent Democratic proposal for tax reform is, there's a much larger child grant, much like they have in other countries, but it would phase out with income. I don't support people like myself getting a universal basic income.
I think on the political side, one of the counters to the idea of, well, Bill Gates gets a check is everybody gets a check. That we don't discriminate based on it because your incomes can change. And we're also going to take away the political power that sometimes you say, oh, well, you know, those quote unquote, you know, poor people get a check and now they're not going to want to work. No, everybody gets a check. You get a check, I get a check, everyone does.
You know, and that's a plausible argument. I've one of my most famous colleagues, Peter Diamond, a Nobel Prize winning expert on Social Security, often said he didn't like the idea of means testing Social Security, of giving just poor people. He said, once the program for the poor, it'll go away. And that's the theory. On the other hand, look at the debate over repealing the Affordable Care Act. Why did Republicans lose that debate? Because they went after Medicaid. Now, Medicaid is a program for the poor, by and large. But it turns out people still like it, even though it's for the poor. So I'm not as convinced it needs to be universal to succeed. I think it's an open question. I think that if you said to me, would I rather have a UBI than nothing? I'd rather a UBI than nothing, even at the cost. But I still would rather, for efficiency of public dollars, I'd rather have more of an income-targeted system.
And I'm not endorsing a UBI. I'm just sort of working through the political arguments because it is fascinating to watch an economist who probably didn't think about working in politics too much and the games that have to be played with this, but that's been part of your work for much of the last decade. So the last question on healthcare then is, what's the biggest lesson you learned, do you think, from working on the Affordable Care Act, and what do you think Democrats should learn as they seek, well, it doesn't have to be just Democrats, I mean, Republicans, what do you think politicians can learn from that?
That's a good question. I think probably, quite frankly, the biggest lesson I learned is a somewhat negative one, which is it's hard to create losers with any policy, and even a policy like the Affordable Care Act, which created many multiples of winners to losers, did create a small number of, basically our idea in the Affordable Care Act was, roughly speaking, leave people alone if they like their health insurance. That was about 80% of Americans. Then the remaining 20%, we made about 17% better off and probably about 3% worse off. Those are people who are, for example, very healthy and benefiting from discriminatory insurance, or the super rich who paid higher taxes. The problem is, we thought, well, that's great. That's 4 to 1 ratio of winners to losers, and the other 80% will sit by the side. The problem is, the losers were loud, the winners were quiet, and the other 80% got convinced they were losers. And it turns out that it's hard to do. I think it was a great policy that really tried to, it was fiscally balanced. It actually lowered the deficit. It turns out it's hard to do major reform without greasing some wheels more. And I think honestly, that's just a lesson we have to learn.
Professor Jonathan Gruber is our guest. As you heard him talking about the ACA, he was one of the architects of the Affordable Care Act, and he's the co-author of the new book, Jumpstarting America, How Breakthrough Science Can Revive Economic Growth. He'll be part of a panel discussion tonight at the University of Rochester at the Hawkins Carlson Room there at the Rush Reese Library. That's at 6:30 tonight, and it'll be followed by a book signing with Professor Gruber. Now, this is not the first book that offers sort of an economic prescription for what happens in towns that have really struggled, but let me just kind of start with how you see the landscape. And in one of the talks you gave at MIT, you were talking about how people have even talked about housing policy and density, and you look at the Palo Altos of the world where, you know, you could try to go in and force housing policy to change and make more people go there, but right now people can't afford to move there and people like their space, so you got to figure out what's actually happening in the Detroits and the Youngstowns and the Rochesters of the world as opposed to saying, well, people just move there. Is that a fair kind of look at the landscape right now?
It's a very fair, and actually the economics field has really evolved on this. I think 15 years ago, we're all like, look, let's just let people move there. You know, and we lamented the housing policies, which make it impossible. People like these low-slung, single-family, $5 million houses in Palo Alto, and they complain about apartment buildings, which would make the city affordable. We said, well, tough luck. Just build the apartment buildings. I think what's changed is realized two things. One is realized that the housing policies won't change. These places are not going to suddenly make housing a lot more affordable. The second is we've seen this incredibly increasing division in our country. And it's a feature we call in economics agglomeration. We like in economics to make up fancy words for pretty sensible things. And agglomeration is just the idea that talented people want to go to where talented people are. And so all this talent is moving to these we call superstar cities, predominantly on the coasts. And that essentially it's not going to be a naturally correcting force. Economists for decades said, well, it'll naturally correct, but it's not happening. And so we think we need federal, active federal policy to correct it. But the policy cannot be like welfare, come back to universal basic. It can't be just find the poorest places and give them money. It has to be something which can promote growth. And that means you have to find places that have the potential to grow. And we think there's dozens of these places around America. So here's what we did in the data. We said find places in America with more than 100,000 working age people, so it's big enough to support a new tech hub, where the population is highly educated, at least 25% college graduates, and where the average house price is less than $265,000 a year. Okay, we identified all those places. That turns out to be 102 cities in 36 states with 80 million people living in them. It's all over the country. And then we made a list. Rochester happens to be number one on the list, conveniently, based on things like educational facilities, population size, and quality of life. But this list covers a lot of this sort of old Rust Belt, a lot of the South, even some places fewer, but some places west of the Mississippi. It's not the places on the coast. But there's dozens and dozens of places like Rochester or Huntsville, Alabama, the original home of the U.S. rocket program, or Tucson, Arizona, or Logan, Utah, or Kansas City, Missouri, which have the potential to be new technology hubs. But honestly, Amazon didn't seriously consider. Okay, and that's what we keep coming back to, the Amazon HQ2 example. That when they put out their offer, despite an America that's quote-unquote booming, 230 cities desperately bid. 230 cities desperately bid for Amazon, offering destructive tax breaks, which would simply mean that if they won, they'd lose because they just end up eviscerating their own public services. Let's instead, we argue, put those cities in a positive competition, a competition to not just offer the biggest tax breaks, but a competition to show that they have the education resources, the skill level, the infrastructure to be the next technology hub. And let's have the government invest enormous resources in technology in those places.
The federal government.
The federal government.
Was the Amazon sweepstakes crass to you?
I think the Amazon sweepstakes was actually probably bad for capitalism. I think there's a lot of, you come back to Bernie Sanders and people who were sort of worried about capitalism, I think it was sort of, it was very crass. And I think last year, local communities, states, counties, cities spent $50 billion in tax breaks to attract companies. That's 30% as large as the entire corporate tax base that localities have. They spent in tax breaks to attract companies. I think it really turns people off. It's a race to the bottom that doesn't do these places any good and certainly is bad for America, because if some place wins, someone else loses. We instead propose in our book, and this book, by the way, should be written with Simon Johnson, who's a very prominent former chief economist of the IMF. So we both come to this from different types of expertise, but a passion about public policy. And our view is, let's set up a race to the top, not a race to the bottom. And the way to do that is to invest in public R&D the way we used to do as a country. You know, Evan, in the decades when America was great, to coin a term, in the decades after World War II, the U.S. economy was founded on a partnership between government R&D spending and the private sector. Satellites, jet aircraft, digital computing, all came out of everything on the internet, all came out of government-led investments partnering with the private sector, peaking in the mid-1960s at 2% of our entire economy being public R&D spending. It's now 0.7% while the rest of the world charges ahead.
Okay. Listeners, if we go throughout the hour, if you want to weigh in, you can email the program connections@wxxi.org. You can call the program 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Our guest is MIT professor Jonathan Gruber, who is the co-author of Jumpstarting America, How Breakthrough Science Can Revive Economic Growth. Jim Sinal, president of NextCore, Inc., and managing director of the Rochester Angel Network. And I would just add, you know, as a journalist, I don't get into rooting games, even for my own city, but of course we want to see Rochester succeed. It's interesting that Buffalo, Duluth, Minnesota are positioning themselves as actual climate refuges in terms of the next American century. There's a lot of advantages that maybe Rochester might have, but realistically, Jim, let me bring you into this discussion here, because when we talk about Rochester as a technology hub of the future, you know, in recent years, we've obviously seen photonics starting to kind of take root, but we also see the critics immediately coming out saying, not enough. Where is it? Fulfill the promises. How do you see that dynamic playing out, just for starters? And then more broadly speaking, how do you see Rochester as a tech hub of the future?
Well, I think the photonics initiative makes perfect sense for our region with the rich history of optics. And then, you know, where does that go longer term, which is into integrated photonics and devices? And it's a long game, right? So any of these very early stage technologies or technology breakthroughs is a long game. So even investing $100 or $200 or $300 million over time in a new facility or a new initiative like AIM Photonics that isn't really physically up and running yet, we're going to have to see how that plays out. But, you know, building on your strengths as a region and then kind of using that beachhead to branch into other adjacent areas is a strategy that makes a lot of sense. And I think that's one of the areas we're focused on in the region.
Professor?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a really instructive story, I think, out of Orlando, Florida. Now, Orlando, Florida is actually the home of the U.S. computer microsimulation industry. It is to computer microsimulation very much what Rochester is to optics. It's gotten a huge investment, and it's grown enormously. They've added – this is not Disney. This is 45 minutes east. They've added 100,000 jobs over the last 30 years based around a new research park they built, et cetera. But the problem, and the problem Rochester's facing, is when the companies get successful enough, they leave. They go to the coast. They go to New York and Seattle. Now, why? Because that's where the venture capital is. 75% of venture capital in America is in six cities in our country. So Orlando, which is booming the sector and a computer sector, that's hot, right? Is still 45th in the country in venture capital. If you want to make Rochester, if we want to make Rochester and cities like Rochester and Orlando and Duluth and others new technology hubs, it's going to take more than a couple $100 million one-time investment. It's going to take the federal government saying we are committing to putting billions of dollars into this place, so not only new companies start here, but they stay here, and the city grows. We need a jump start, because if you don't put serious resources in, companies are just going to still go to the same coastal cities they're going to today.
How much are we talking about? And again, not just a one shot. We're talking about an annual basis.
What Simon and I propose in the book is we propose that if you put $100 billion a year, that's 0.5% of GDP. That would take us in terms of public R&D back to where we were in 1981. We would rise from being about 10th in the world to close to the top. Wouldn't be where we were in 1960s at 2%, but at least we'd be back in the mix. Where an investor of that size could create 4 million jobs around America. But the way we'd spend it would not just be $100 billion new R&D. It would be location-based. We suggest setting up 20 to 30 new technology hubs to be chosen by an apolitical commission, modeled after the base closing commission. We have experience with this. We've made tough political decisions before. But this would be a technology hub opening commission, and we'd take that money. And so it would be billions of dollars every year for some significant period of time to specific locations, enough so the company like Amazon sits up and notices and say, wow, maybe I do want to be in Rochester. They're getting serious resources. They're going to grow as a technology hub.
20 to 30
places across the country.
What happens to the list of cities that don't win in this?
Well, once again, we hope this book will raise more questions than answer them. There's a ton of questions the book raises we don't have the answer to. In my view, we don't talk about this in the book. In my view, this would be a multiple round thing where one place would win for a number of years. It has to be a number of years because you got to commit. But then there'd be new competitions, maybe every decade, maybe something like that, where new cities can jump on board. But look, the point is, if we're at that level of questions, I'm delighted. I want to get to the point where we recognize two things. Recognize A, America is falling behind the rest of the world because we're no longer recognizing that the private sector doesn't do the R&D it needs to. The private sector, and I'm a big believer in private sector. We have an incubator leader here, believes in the private sector. The private sector invests to the extent that their research raises their own bottom line, not to the extent that it causes national growth. That's the thing we need to recognize. The government needs to partner with the private sector to lead R&D. The second thing to recognize is if we just put more of it into Boston and San Francisco, that's not going to grow the country in a balanced way. We need more R&D, and it needs to be spread around the country.
Some of our listeners may wonder, $100 billion a year, how do you fund it?
Well, basically, we think of this as an investment, and here's a great story to illustrate it. The Human Genome Project. In the mid-1980s, a Nobel Prize-winning scientist who had started Biogen, a very prominent biotech firm, wanted to start a company to map the human genome. He discovered the Nobel for how to do this, and he wanted to do it. No private company would give them even $10 million to do it because there's no money in it for them. The federal government set up the Human Genome Project, $3 billion over 13 years to map the human genome. Today, because that project existed, we have a genomics industry dominated by America with 300,000 jobs, an average salary of $70,000 a year, and it pays $6 billion a year in taxes. Twice the 15-year investment is paid every single year in taxes. This investment that will pay it back, if you look at economic studies, the rate of return to R&D is enormous. This investment will pay itself back.
Jim, are you comfortable with the idea of another competition that Rochester would have to be involved in?
I'm very confident in Rochester's ability in any kind of competition. And, you know, fundamentally, the things that are presented in the book are all true, as Jonathan mentioned. You know, private sector R&D in basic research has declined, you know, almost to very little amounts. Other countries are doing a lot more. It's not in the best interest of shareholders for these companies to do stuff versus more applied kind of research and development. And so the country has to do something. If we want to have our technology edge and create jobs and economic growth, we have to do something. And so a competition model, I think, could make sense. I think with the assets that we've got here in our region, like probably the other 101 other cities that are in the book, we fare very well. And we have the talent base and all those categories that were mentioned that we could do a really good job.
All right, listeners, after our only break of the hour, we'll take some of your feedback. If you want to email the program, connections@wxxi.org. Our guest, you just heard Jim Sinal, president of NextCorp Inc., and managing director of the Rochester Angel Network, and Jonathan Gruber, professor of economics at MIT and the co-author of the new book, Jumpstarting America, How Breakthrough Science Can Revive Economic Growth. They'll be part of a panel discussion tonight, followed by a book signing with Professor Gruber. Starts at 6:30 tonight at Rush Reese Library at the University of Rochester. So we'll come back to some of your feedback and continue on these themes next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation about the Reshaping Rochester series and the emphasis on social equity and design. Most architects in this country come from a pretty narrow social class. Most of them look the same. How would our cities look different if that weren't the case, if there was more equity when it comes to design? And how can a pipeline be created to change that? We discuss it next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, talking to Professor Jonathan Gruber about his new book, Jumpstarting America, How Breakthrough Science Can Revive Economic Growth. And Jim Sinal is here from the Rochester Angel Network and NextCorp Inc., and they'll be part of the panel discussion tonight. Now, these questions about reviving economic growth, there's a lot of different prescriptions out there. And I was rereading a piece that was published in the Atlantic Monthly by one of the fellows at the Open Markets Institute, Matthew Stoller, who says that really he sees the biggest economic problem that, starting in 1975, he says Democrats used to be the party of anti-economic concentration. They were the Brandeis party, the trust busters, and they sort of moved on to different issues starting with the so-called Watergate babies in 1975. And that for about 40 years, Democrats have been sort of Republican light on the subject of economic concentration. Do you agree with that framing? And do you think there's too much economic concentration in this country?
I think it's clear there's too much economic concentration. We see it in particular in healthcare, actually, in places like Boston, where one company's dominated the healthcare system, but we see it throughout. But I think both parties have, I mean, you're right, Republicans were never big on fighting economic concentration. The Democrats have sort of gone away from it. And I think it's been a big problem. I'm hoping that regulators start to look more seriously. I think it's hard to break up companies, to be honest. I mean, Elizabeth Warren's talked about breaking up some big companies. That's pretty traumatic and hard. But it's a dynamic economy. New giant companies are going to emerge. I think the main thing is to be more careful going forward, that we don't end up with these giant companies dominating the economy, and to think about how we get the returns from these companies into the hands of people. Because the other problem that's related to this is taxes are falling. And these companies are paying less and less tax. And that's why sort of I talked in the book, we have the proposal both more R&D and location-based. We have a third plank in our proposal, which is what we call the innovation dividend, which is we want the returns from these new companies that grow out of these incubators. When the incubator creates a new company, it stays in Rochester and it's really wealthy, but then the guys just get really rich. We want those returns to be shared with the taxpayer. And so one proposal we have, for example, is that when you set up a new tech hub, the government owns the land around the tech hub. And when that land gets more valuable, that goes into a fund, which gets paid as a flat dividend to all Americans to make sure we all benefit from these new companies growing.
When it comes to breaking up companies, I mean, you say it's hard. There's lots of things that are hard. What do you mean by hard?
Well, I think that basically, how do you break up Google? What does that even mean? When we broke up AT&T, there were regional bell companies. There was sort of a natural way to break it up. I don't even know. You know, people talk about breaking up Google and Amazon. I'm just not even sure what that means. I think we have to recognize those behemoths are here. We need to try to set a better landscape for competition, but we also need to figure out better ways to get the returns of their growth, which once again was based on government-funded R&D. All this stuff they do wouldn't have existed except for DARPA and a lot of the government-funded R&D that grew the digital computer industry and the software industry. Those returns should not be just going to create a few billionaires in Silicon Valley. They've got to get back to all Americans.
I think the Stollers of the world would argue that, you know, we may not need kind of these new programs if we would kind of step in and do the trust busting ourselves or prevent the economic concentration from happening in the first place. That maybe these mid-sized markets, you know, the Youngstowns, even the Detroits and Rochesters, wouldn't hollow out or wouldn't have hollowed out if we would have been more protective of economic concentration. Do you think there's something to that?
I think there is something to that. I talked about agglomeration as a place-based concept, but it's also sort of a company-based concept that basically once, you know, one of the best stories in the book, it actually comes from a book by a famous economist named Marika Moretti, is a story of how Seattle got famous. Well, you may not know that Microsoft started in Albuquerque. When Bill Gates dropped out, he went to Albuquerque. And it was Albuquerque at that point was a much more natural home for a tech company. Seattle was a dying industrial town with a billboard at the airport that said, "With the last person to lease, please shut out the lights." Yet Bill Gates was from Seattle. He wanted to go back there. And so he moved Microsoft to Seattle. Fast forward to the mid-1990s, Jeff Bezos hops in a car out of New York to set up Amazon. Does he go to his hometown of Albuquerque? No, he goes to Seattle. Okay. And now we've got this concentration in Seattle. We're creating the billionaires there. We need to spread that wealth, both geographically and through the income distribution.
Patrick writes to us and says, has Professor Gruber seen anything in his career that would make him believe that the market cannot fix everything?
Yeah, I've seen lots in my career to make me believe
it. It sounds like your proposal is here.
I mean, basically, look, Simon and I, Simon's at the Sloan Business School at MIT. We believe in the private sector. The public sector cannot solve this, but the private sector won't solve it either. Okay, we have decades of experience that the private sector will not do the R&D that spills over, that benefits others, and the private sector will not finance the innovative R&D that spills over, protect others. Let's do a simple example. A classic example of a growth industry of the future is batteries. Battery technology is a huge growth industry of the future. There was a company in Boston called Boston Power that was creating a new innovative lithium-ion battery. They had customers including Hewlett-Packard and Saab. They wanted to build a big new plant which would have employed 500 people in Western Massachusetts. They couldn't raise the capital for American capitalists to do it, but they could from China. That plant moved to China. It's now twice as big as it was, and that industry is growing in China rather than America. That's the competition we face if we don't have the government get involved.
Daniel writes to us and says, I listened to Dr. Gruber talk about manufacturing winners and losers and was frustrated. It seems that even in hindsight, the architects of the ACA still haven't learned a lesson. We were beaten by propaganda. The 80% of the ACA didn't wake up and just magically decide they were losers in this game. They were convinced by news organizations spewing stories by reporters that didn't do their homework. This propaganda was at the behest of the real losers of the ACA, the super rich. We can do anything we put our collective minds to, full stop. People who have failed to learn the real lessons of past failures shouldn't be the ones telling us what is possible. It's from Daniel.
Well, Daniel, I mean, I appreciate the sentiment. I wouldn't say I've failed to learn the lesson. I think that you have to be realistic about, because of the concentration that was of wealth that was mentioned, there is enormous power in the hands of the few. And I think that ultimately we hope as a society to address that. But in the meantime, we have to be realistic that if we keep batting our heads against those few and getting nowhere, we're going to be stuck. We need to think about solutions that are this elusive word, bipartisanship. Remember that old word? We think about solutions that both sides can get behind. Look, right now, the Republicans aren't talking about science or much of anything. But behind closed doors, both parties support the idea of more science, more R&D. This is the kind of thing I think the whole country can get behind.
Why is it behind closed doors? Why are people so politically incapable of none of this is very it's very heartening, to be honest with you.
Well, it is disheartening, and I'm scalded by my experience with the ACA, to be honest. But I think the problem is that it is hard to make change. As to quote President Obama, it's hard to make change, and you have a set of vested interests, for example, on climate science, who make a lot of money off denying climate science. It's hard. It's a hard topic. Okay, climate science is complicated and hard. Okay, and it's easy, therefore, to spread disinformation, and when it's in their financial vested interests. And I think we're in this vicious cycle of how do you fight that, but at the same time fighting against that propaganda.
Okay, Jim.
I just want to jump back into talking about the breakup of companies and the concentration of companies, and to me, it's just the completely wrong way to think about all this stuff. So. It's almost a zero-sum game thinking that way. Oh, these companies are too big. We've got to break them up and kind of spread that around. To me, that doesn't make any sense at all. what we should be thinking about is how do we create more of those big companies and in a more diversified way and more spread out around other places. The Kauffman Foundation and others for years and years have talked about most of the net new jobs come from young companies. So how are we forming new companies? How are we creating those next big companies? How are we creating that next growth in all these regions? Is the better way to think about this and looking at the data of where economic growth comes from, jumpstarting it with more research funding, more technologies, more companies formed, and then those are the unicorns that kind of grow big.
But just to kind of make sure I understand what you're saying here, Jim, I mean, if you go back throughout history, there have been cases where you may have an industry where there are mid-sized companies at a couple dozen cities. Then concentration happens, and maybe there's one or two regions that become super winners, but everybody else loses those. That's what concentration can bring. It can sort of suck the mid-size companies away from those communities. And the concern is, can you safeguard against that? You don't think you can safeguard against that?
I think, you know, obviously there's in the private sector, right, if there's advantages for companies to be in a more dense area because of the talent is there and other things are there or the funding is there, right, that's a market force that's going to make that stuff happen. But there's lots of industries and sub-industries and sub-sectors that, again, back to the book, if there's ways to jumpstart those next things, I mean, there's nothing to say that if there were, I mean, use the battery technology, if there were new anode technology or fuel cell technology or something that was a major focus of a new initiative, that it would necessarily go to Boston if some of these other regions could use the talent that they've got in a way to compete for that.
Okay. Let me pick up on that. I think that's a really important point, which is there are dozens of exciting, innovative opportunities that can create mega companies of tomorrow. The problem right now we have is the mega companies in everything want to be in Boston, Seattle. So Boston grew up as biotech, but now a bunch of computer companies, software companies want to be in Boston too. So the problem isn't just that they're big companies. It's all those big companies want to be together in a few set of cities. If we can spread those big companies out, you know, it wasn't a problem when Kodak was huge. It was spread out and Rochester thrived. We need to think about a situation where big companies are spread around the country. That said, I do think we have to worry about antitrust. I think it but does have to be applied judiciously.
Okay. John writes to us and says, government ownership of land surrounding these companies and $100 billion a year, are we moving towards what the DSA wants? I think he's quoting the Democratic Socialists of America.
So, the word socialism gets thrown around.
That probably drives you up a wall.
Well, look. I understand the concern, but let's be clear. First of all, $100 billion. If we raise $100 billion more in tax, right now, our tax burden is a share of GDP. We are currently 12th from the bottom among all developed countries. If we raised $100 billion more in tax, we'd be 12th from the bottom. Okay, we wouldn't even skip over the next nearest country. $100 billion in tax, it's less than Trump's tax cut, much less, and it's going to do much more for economic growth. So it's not a big number in the scheme of things, is point one. Okay, we don't want to just give people money through tax cuts, we want to invest. Investment pays back. So the $100 billion, I think, is okay because that's going to pay itself back. The government ownership of land, I agree. That's sort of a bit out there. I agree. But I want to start a conversation about how do we ensure that if the new photonics giant photonics company comes and Rochester adds 100,000 jobs, that it's just not these couple of guys getting super rich, but we share the benefits of that, which are based on government funding. We share with everyone. Land ownership is one way. We can talk about other ways, but let's make sure that we avoid the problems we've made in the past of as these new companies emerge that we're sharing the benefits with others.
Well, now I'll follow up on John's email and say land ownership is one idea. How about the government owning the means of production?
Well, this is when my business school co-author gets a little bit more scared than maybe I do. I think that we worry about government having equity shares in companies because it can distort company business making. That said, my view is basically, I think if you look at venture capital in America, I keep beating them up as the bad guys. But actually, the good news about venture capital is it's tiny, tiny, tiny. It's 1/8 of 1% of all financial capital in America. Okay. And when that sector gets more resources, they do take more risks and invest in more novel things. So why can't the government inject more money, matching funds, into venture capital investments and actually benefit from an incredibly innovative venture capital sector, but loosen the capital constraints that don't let them take risks? Now, if they did, that would mean the government might own a share of the companies that result. And that is a consequence we have to worry about and think about, and it's important to depoliticize that. But I don't think it's the end of the world.
Okay. Well, here is Ted writing to us saying, Evan, the government has a poor record of picking winners and losers when it comes to economic development. He points to the Buffalo Billion, which Professor Gruber may or may not have some familiarity with, but he says it seems like the government is a poor venue for distributing research dollars, and there's also the fear of politics getting in the mix. How about giving the private sector tax incentives to increase research?
Great question. And I think exactly the kind of conversation we want to open with this book and not necessarily close. Here's the, so two parts of the question. First of all, why won't tax breaks be enough? And let's be clear, the Trump tax cut actually reduced the R&D tax credit, which is really disappointing. We want to move forward on R&D, not reduce it. The reason tax credits aren't enough is because of the two failures I talked about. A, the private sector companies don't do the innovative, growth-creating technology investment that we need. They invest in what increases their profits, not what increases the size of the economy necessarily. The second point is it doesn't solve our locational problem. It's just going to be more money going to Seattle and Boston and LA and New York. It doesn't solve that locational problem. So that's why I don't think tax credits are enough. Picking winners, huge concern, huge concern. And probably the biggest concern of a proposal like this is anytime you target, you pick. So that's why we think we would only recommend this in a depoliticized way. So let me talk about an example. Okay.
I'm a big skeptic on depoliticization of some picking government allocation resources. Okay.
But I have a comparable example.
Okay.
One of the hardest things this nation's had to do in the last 50 years is close military bases. That is incredibly hard. You're taking away jobs from cities. There's nothing that's harder to do than close a military base. What did we do? We set up the Base Realignment and Closing Committee. Remember House of Cards Season 1? That's what he's testifying in front of. We have closed hundreds of military bases. What did it do? It was an apolitical organization which recommended a list of bases to close that Congress could only vote on an up or down basis. It couldn't pick and choose. Why can't we follow that same model? We have an example. Why can't we have a tech hub opening commission? The scales are comparable to all the military bases we've closed. It's probably a bigger scale, but basically we can do it. But I totally agree, we cannot do this unless we make it apolitical.
I think that's a fair kind of historical paradigm drawn, and anything is corruptible. But I think I understand why you're drawing on it. In this case, though, closure is one thing. The creation of something new, could you guard against all of the forces that would try to intervene and influence?
I would argue it's harder to those forces are worse when you're closing something and opening something. When you're closing something, you've already got existing vested interests that are going to lose their jobs. So it's actually politically harder, I think, to close something and open something. I'm not saying it's easy, and I completely agree with your concern and listeners' concern about making sure that this is apoliticized. But once again, we have to move forward somehow.
All right, in our last few minutes, Jim, what do you think is the most important grain to take forward from the book and some of these concepts? Because as the professor has said, he hopes this is kind of the starting point for a national conversation. What do you want to kind of build upon here?
Well, I think a lot of things that we talked about, the fact that private sector basic research is down, but there's a lot of examples of where funding things has produced a lot of jobs and economic growth and kept the United States ahead. But you can take that on a regional level too. So funding things can help regional growth. Will we get $100 billion a year out to the private sector and to these regions tomorrow? Obviously, no. So I think what we need to think about is, again, what are we building on tomorrow and the next day and the next day? And we're seeing a lot of strength. So we already have, in our new incubator, which just opened, we have over 60 startup companies combined with others in town. There's 100 startups here. We're seeing some organic things, software companies that are moving here, not because of incentives, but because of talent coming out of the universities and all that stuff. So building on the things that ranked highly in the book, in the categories, our talent base, our educated workforce, the low cost of living, commute times, all the things that we always talk about here locally, and being more strategic in how we go after those things, I think will help. Photonics is one industry we've talked about. One of our programs, Luminate, attracts photonics startups from around the world that are here. And a lot of people probably don't know that, but from Israel, New Zealand, and all over the place, they're here in Rochester because of the benefits that we've got. So continuing to work on the things we're working on while we advocate for, on a more national policy, more basic research and development to keep our country at the forefront, I think, is important.
Okay. And Professor Gruber?
I think here's the key fact, which is that economists estimate that every dollar invested in R&D yields a 50% rate of return for the economy. Okay, there is a huge rate of return, and we used to do this. The point is, it's not just economic theory, it's not just evidence, it's history, too. Even if you don't like economics, just look at the history. What made the U.S. economy great in the decades after World War II was a government-led R&D boom. Okay, we need to do that again. That's critical. But it's not going to happen if we just say, let's have a bigger R&D tax credit, or if we just say, let's just spend another $100 billion, because people are going to say, we're sick of giving money to San Francisco and New York and Boston. It's only going to happen if we use it as a way to get the rest of the country growing and take the strengths of the U.S., our diversity of opportunities and our large scale of our country, take advantage of that.
In our last 30 seconds or so, certainly the framing is that the Rochesters of this country would have a pretty good chance here to be in the mix here. would you cap the size of the city that could get benefits from this?
No, actually, what's neat, you don't cap the size, but I think you should cap the house price. I think basically you should say it's not about size.
That's
it's
the
about,
metric.
It's about making sure that you don't become Seattle, that you have a viable zoning plan and a plan for sustainable growth so that if Rochester does become the next tech hub, it does so in a way you can still afford to live there.
The name of the new book is Jumpstarting America, How Breakthrough Science Can Revive Economic Growth. Professor Jonathan Gruber of MIT is the co-author. He's been with us for the hour, and you can meet him tonight at a book signing and a panel discussion starting at 6:30 p.m. at Rush Reese Library at the University of Rochester's River Campus. Nice having you. Thank you for taking the time to be here.
Thanks so much.
And our thanks to Jim Sinal, president of NextCore Inc. and managing director of the Rochester Angel Network. He'll be there tonight as well. Jim, always good. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
All right, short break. More connections coming up.